Welcome to Understory, this 25th day of October 2017. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Yesterday was United Nations Day, celebrating the moment in 1945 when the UN officially came into being. Quite significantly, the United Nations Charter begins with three words: we, the peoples. Although United Nations is made up of countries, there's an implication in the UN Charter's opening, we, the peoples, that the UN must ultimately serve humanity. Antonio Guterres, Secretary-General of the United Nations, spoke this week for United Nations Day about the challenges being faced by the peoples of the world.
Our world faces many grave challenges: widening conflicts and inequality, extreme weather and deadly intolerance, security threats, including nuclear weapons. We have the tools and wealth to overcome these challenges. All we need is the will.
Guterres says we have the tools and wealth to meet these challenges. All we need is the will. He specifically highlights nuclear weapons too, which are weighing heavily on many people's minds, with immediate concerns about North Korea and the current US president. The first treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons was adopted on the 7th of July 2017, with the support of nearly two-thirds of United Nations member states. But while people around the world might want to see the end of nuclear terror, there are some nation states preferring things as they are. Nuclear possessor states and their allies want to be able to keep their 15,000 nuclear missiles and only attend to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, which gives these nuclear possessor states prestigious seats at the security table. The head of the United Nations General Assembly, Miroslav Lajak, said recently,
"You cannot ignore the will of 120 plus member states of the United Nations. So it has no direct impact, it's not binding on the NPT process, but to ignore it would be a big mistake, because it would also mean that you are ignoring almost two-thirds of the membership of the United Nations."
The people's will has also been recognised through the granting of the Nobel Peace Prize this year to the civil society group, Melbourne-based International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. The Nobel Prize Committee awarded ICAN the Peace Prize, quote, for its work to draw attention to the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons, and for its groundbreaking efforts to achieve a treaty-based prohibition of such weapons, unquote. The Nobel Peace Prize is welcome recognition, according to the United Nations High Representative for Disarmament, Izumi Nakamitsu.
Moving towards a world free of nuclear weapons is really today an urgent priority. So this Nobel Peace Prize really is very significant in terms of a timing and the situation in which we are all living in today.
ICAN has written an open letter to Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull saying that the global non-proliferation treaty regime has failed, that nuclear weapons, quote, are illegitimate, immoral, and now illegal, unquote, threatening Australia's existence. Today on Understory, Adrian Glamorgan brings you interviews with two Australians who have been active in the United Nations processes, particularly disarmament. Adrian spoke in Brisbane to Gareth Evans about what the former Labor Foreign Minister learned from Australia's championing of the Chemical Weapons Treaty, which banned chemical weapons of mass destruction.
We have the evidence with chemical weapons, we've got the evidence of Biological Weapons Convention, and nuclear weapons should certainly be next on the list because they are the most indiscriminately inhumane of any class of weapon ever invented.
Gareth Evans co-wrote an important United Nations report called The Responsibility to Protect, which in part deals with this responsibility the nations of the world have for crimes against humanity or genocide happening within any country. Adrian Glamorgan asked Gareth Evans about the relationship of the doctrine of responsibility to protect and moves for nuclear disarmament.
Gareth Evans, do you think there is any relationship between the responsibility to protect and the moves for nuclear disarmament?
Well, there is, in the sense that the responsibility to protect is about preventing and reacting to mass atrocity crimes, crimes against humanity. And there is no doubt whatsoever, because the International Court has essentially said so, that to use a nuclear weapon in any circumstances where a country is not totally at existential risk is a crime against humanity. That said, I think in policy terms, they're on two essentially different tracks. I mean, responsibility to protect principle in practice is essentially about energising governments and the Security Council to respond to unfolding atrocity crime situations like Rwanda or Bosnia-Srebrenica or Syria or Libya, and to ensure that people don't just treat them as nobody else's business. The nuclear disarmament enterprise is obviously hugely complex, difficult, and got to be approached in a very long-term sort of a way. We're off to a good start with the ban treaty being recently negotiated, but clearly we don't have buy-in from the countries that are most crucial to that, and that's going to be a very long haul. Whether the responsibility to protect principle helps much in getting that change of mind on the heart of those governments, I'm not sure, but at least it's a big moral principle that's out there, and it does have the relevance that I've described.
Gareth Evans wrote Responsibility to Protect with Ramesh Thakur, currently head of the Centre for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament at the Australian National University. Professor Thakur was once Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations and has consulted for and advised the Australian and New Zealand governments on arms control, disarmament and international security issues. Adrian Glamorgan spoke to Ramesh Thakur in Canberra.
So you would seem very well qualified to give us an assessment what the hopes and frustrations have been.
There's bad news and good news and then again bad news. The bad news is we are now 49 years since the NPT was adopted and came into effect in 1970s. It's now 21 years since the World Court came down with this advisory opinion strengthening the Article 6 obligation of the NPT, saying that all countries have the obligation not just to engage in, but actually to conclude good faith negotiations on nuclear disarmament. The nuclear weapon states, the five of them that are recognized as nuclear weapon states under the NPT, have always insisted that the obligation is limited to promising to get rid of the weapons eventually, and they still maintain that promise, but that there's no particular practical outcome that is a legal obligation within any time frame that anyone can specify. This attitude has bred growing frustration and anger and exasperation. And more countries effectively have concluded that none of the nuclear weapon states are serious about nuclear disarmament. Therefore, we need to look at an alternative framework. Why an alternative framework? Because clearly the nuclear weapon states have succeeded in converting the NPT from what was meant as a prohibition regime into only a non-proliferation regime. We will use the NPT to enforce non-proliferation on everyone else, but no one else can enforce disarmament on us. This created problems. If you come back to the start of 2017, of nine countries that have nuclear weapons, four in addition to the original five, no nuclear arms control discussions were being held between any two or more of the nine countries. In other words, nuclear disarmament had stalled completely. In the meantime, nuclear threats and risks had multiplied and intensified, starting with geopolitical tensions in Europe and Middle East and South Asia between India and Pakistan, but also between India and China, where they had a 10-week border standoff, and of course in Northeast Asia with North Korea and the surrounding countries there as well. The four Asian countries are all expanding their nuclear weapons stockpiles, all four of them. Fortunately, none of the others are, but all the others are also modernizing and upgrading. Faced with this, civil society, led by the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which has wonderfully received this year's Nobel Peace Prize, and very well deserved, I would add, teamed up with many liberal, like-minded governments to see if they could re-inject some momentum and reinvigorate the nuclear disarmament cause. And the hook that they used drew upon that old 1996 World Court advisory opinion, which for present purposes had three significant elements. One, they said that any use of nuclear weapons would generally be contrary to international law, and in particular humanitarian law. Second, they said, we cannot conclude definitively that the use of nuclear weapons would be justified even in the extreme circumstances of the very survival of a state being under threat. And third was the part about obligation to conclude, not just negotiate, nuclear disarmament.
It's much more than a prohibition, isn't it?
Well, it's a comprehensive set of prohibitions in the plural. It's prohibitions on manufacture, on use, on possession, on transfer, on receipt, on testing, all sorts of issues, on assistance. And it applies to everyone. Every state party has to abide by those. It's not like the NPT, which divides the world into nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots. And, of course, the NPT doesn't include four countries that have nuclear weapons. This one will apply to everyone. So it has that. And the General Assembly then convened the conference, which was in two stages, in March and then June, July. And at the on the final day, on 7th July, 122 states adopted this treaty. Now, there's a couple of interesting things on this. Firstly, 122 states, these are all NPT states parties in good standing with the treaty. That's about two-thirds of NPT states parties. So this is not a group of countries that reject and oppose and are working to undermine the NPT. This is a group of countries that are exasperated at the failure to complete the third leg of the NPT and have decided to strengthen the normative pressures to bring that about. Second, these countries include countries from the global north and south. It's not just the old NAM constituency anymore. Third interesting feature is none of the countries with nuclear weapons, including the five nuclear weapon states, and none of the umbrella states, including Australia, attended the conference. Now, if we look at the Article 6 text of the NPT, it calls on each state party to negotiate in and, as per the World Court Advisory Opinion, conclude. This is not limited to countries that have nuclear weapons. Every NPT state party is required to negotiate and conclude disarmament negotiations for nuclear weapons. Remember, I said earlier, in 2017, there was no nuclear arms control discussion going on between any two countries with nuclear weapons. This is a duly constituted multilateral conference mandated by the United Nations. I know that DFAT has claimed that their non-attendance was legal. As a layperson, as a non-lawyer, I cannot for the life of me see how this is not a violation of Australia's and every umbrella state and every NPT state party, including the five nuclear weapon states, their legal obligation to take part. I'm not saying they had to sign the treaty that was adopted. That's different. But I do believe that the states not attending the conference at all, given the circumstances of no other discussions, given that this was duly constituted, UN mandated, I think non-attendance was a violation of the Article 6 obligation of every state party.
Australia might argue that it's got a process with Japan, that it's trying to vivify the NPT treaty. Is there a case to say that Australia is doing anything, and can we do anything about a violation if it occurs?
We can't do anything about a violation. It's non-enforceable. I'm just saying I think it was a mistake not to attend. I think if we had attended and other like-minded states like Canada and Norway had attended, we could have played the traditional role we have played in terms of our technical expertise in drafting a treaty that is more robust, that is sound, that is potentially easier to make compatible with NPT obligations, and therefore we might have been able to at least consider joining in later stages. Not to attend and then to criticize, I think that is a height of hypocrisy. So that was where I disagree with the Australian person. Now, of course, yes, we are engaged with the Japanese in NPTI. We do various other things. They haven't really amounted to much. It's been very weak and ineffectual. And I think they need to do a much better job of delivering some practical outcomes rather than saying we are doing our best. It's just not good enough.
Gareth Evans, too, believes Australia missed out on helping make a better treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons.
I'd like Australia to be very much more active on the nuclear disarmament issue than we have been. We didn't even participate in the nuclear ban negotiations to, you know, try and perhaps make it a more workable and practical step-by-step process. We just threw up our hands and listened to what the Americans were telling us, don't have anything to do with this, and I thought that was an abdication of our independence and any useful role to play.
The treaty was then opened for signature on 20th September. 50 states signed it immediately, but you only need 50 ratifications, after which 90 days from that date, it comes into effect. So this is the new institutional reality. They say, well, you can't just wish away nuclear weapons, it's a reality, true. Now that applies to the treaty as well. To go back to an earlier comment, the main impact of the treaty is going to be normative. It increases the normative pressure. It completely delegitimizes the possession of nuclear weapons. None of the states can now say our possession is legitimated by the NPT because that has been overtaken by the new treaty. They know that. Therefore, their argument about this is irrelevant, has no effect, is a deliberately false argument. If it was totally ineffectual, they would ignore it. The fact that they have tried so hard to undermine it, and we have on the record letters that American Secretary of State has written, for example, to other governments, saying if you sign, it will have consequences for our bilateral relationship, does show that they have taken steps to undermine it because they are indeed worried about the effect of it. When I say it has a normative impact, what I mean is it will recalibrate the normative context, the totality of laws, international law, humanitarian law, human rights law, norms, codes of conduct, social purposes, values, which shape both how we think about nuclear weapons and how we act in relation to nuclear weapons. So it does have a normative impact. There are issues that will need to be resolved in terms of some technical issues of safeguard standards. I think there is a case to be made that the new treaty weakens the existing safeguard standards. There will need to be some reconciliation of the different institutional setups, which may work to the NPT advantage. Under the new treaty, there are provisions for calling emergency session of states' parties to be convened by the Secretary General. That could be done if we have another threat of withdrawal of a state party from the NPT, for example. This was an issue that we were never able to resolve with North Korea. It said in 2003 it's withdrawing. If you look at the UN website, the Office of Disarmament Affairs still lists North Korea as a state party of the NPT. So we can use some of the institutional innovations which point to the deficits on the NPT to do that. In the immediate future, given that we have this crisis in North Korea, I think it highlights another potentially serious weakness of the new treaty. For the foreseeable future, for all the weaknesses and criticisms of the UN Security Council on democratic and representational grounds, which I fully share, the fact remains, for the foreseeable future, there is no alternative to the UN Security Council as the only legitimate legal enforcement agency for maintaining international peace and security, including nuclear peace. Under the new treaty, the main countries that are now delegitimized for their nuclear weapons possession are the five permanent members. How then can they be the primary enforcers of nuclear peace if they are the primary violators of this new legal norm? And that remains a question that I think, I'm not sure that even the advocates and activists have thought it through. It's something that will need to be addressed with some sense of urgency. Otherwise, we are in for some difficult times.
You've been listening to Understory as we celebrate United Nations Day 2017 with Australia missing in action on the new nuclear weapons treaty. We've spoken to two key Australian figures in the debate about banning weapons of mass destruction, that's Gareth Evans and Ramesh Thakur, as well as bringing you moments from the Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, the head of the General Assembly, Miroslav Lajak, and the High Representative on Disarmament, Izumi Nakamitsu. The United Nations hardly ever features in mainstream media unless there's some crisis or an Australian speaks in New York. But here on Community Radio, we're demonstrating the importance of knowing more about the UN, especially around disarmament, as we meet more of the people who play a role inside and outside the buildings in New York and Geneva to make the world a safer place. Informed citizens are now contacting their local MPs, asking them to support Australia signing the new nuclear weapons ban to protect we, the peoples of the world. I'm Elizabeth Poe. Thanks to Adrian Glamorgan. Understory will be back same time, same planet next week with more to explore in the world of environment and sustainability.